First of all, thank you so much for coming this morning. It's been a long week. I'm tired, so you must be tired. And so it's early as well. So happy Hindu New Year as well. Apparently it's the first day of the year, so maybe auspicious. So what I want to tell you about today is actually a problem that is very much work in progress. But I thought, you know, I was motivated to actually push it forward so that I could talk to you about it. And it's basically the problem of energy technology and the change that must happen, that is happening and that must happen in the coming decades. And you may not think about this necessarily as a search and retrieval and data analysis problem, but I'll try to convince you otherwise. It's basically a place where many of the things that we discussed in this meeting come together as well. It's a place where there's a social process going on, where you have innovation, you have massive technological change that is happening and that will have to happen in the near future. You have economics at work, and you have social dynamics, and you also have the digital traces of all this, namely, you know, in all kinds of ways you can imagine, but in very particular ways, in measures of innovation in science and technology, namely patents and publications. And what I'll talk about today is basically how can one track the progress in this change, basically from a fossil fuel-based energy system, global system, to a system that has to be decarbonized, and that's supposed to happen, you know, in our lifetime. So, can we see what's happening now, what's been happening in the past, and how that, and basically, if you could, what are the predictors of future trends, and in particular, can those be accelerated? So the outline is basically, I'll give you some very basics. Probably all of you might have an interest in this area, but I'll give you some very basics with some of my own perspective of what the problem is. I'll try to convince you. There's actually a growing field of looking at patenting as sort of the digital signatures of technological innovation and scientific innovation to some extent. So as papers might be for scientific innovation. So the idea is, from this information, what can we tell about how technology is changing? But remember as well that a patent is basically a claim on future production, so it's basically also sort of looking into the future. And there's a growing literature of this in all kinds of emerging industries like biotech and nanotech, and there's some precedent on energy, but we believe this is sort of the most extensive data set that's been assembled, and the analysis we're doing, I think, is the most extensive one also to date. And then I'll tell you a little bit about work that Jasmine Kaur mostly and I have been doing on basically assembling all patents worldwide on various energy technologies. And then I'll describe some of the analysis of that data, namely, you know, which nations are inventing in which sectors. We also have information about companies and universities, but that's harder to parse since the different discussions, so we won't talk about that today. Then we'll talk about temporal trends, what's been happening in the past and what is likely to happen in the future. And then I'll finish with networks. Basically, you can start looking at the social structure of these fields and try to see if something special is happening. And I'll try to motivate the fact that both in the dynamical and the network structural analysis, that certain trends that are general to scientific and technological innovation that you see here as well. So I'll show you more as examples than as principles, but I'll try to allude to those. There are certain interesting things that happen whenever you have scientific and technological discovery. And they are quantitative and predictable. So very quickly, the problem of energy is not so much that it has been framed sometimes in the past in terms of us running out of fossil fuels. That may be true if you look far away in time enough, but the main problem is climate change. It's basically the fact that we're putting too much carbon in the atmosphere, and that this is a famous Keeling curve. This is, I thought this was delicious because it's from the previous administration. It's probably Al Gore, you know, and it's probably in his talk. But this is the Keeling curve, which is basically the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. And this is a very famous measurement of basically the annual variations over the last 50 years. And so the problem is obviously that we're burning stuff that is organic to create energy. And the worldwide breakdown is more or less something like this. 25% is coal. Natural gas has been increasing. It's almost that. Petroleum is the largest single component. And then basically other traditional, but some decarbonized sources are on smaller ranges. But this is the number to keep an eye on, which is this is supposed to be the future, but in terms of the present, things like solar and wind are a very small fraction of the total energy production system in the world. And that's where people think we have to go. But in any case, we're starting from a very small base of production. The main problem is actually a problem of, so while it's conceivable that oil may, you know, we typically have 50 years of reserves looking ahead, and that oil may have passed its peak, it's arguable if that's true or not, but since it relies on unknowns, the problem that's very clear is coal. There's plenty of coal, at least for a couple centuries, and the main emitters, the main polluters are the U.S. and China have plenty of coal, and their energy production system is based, the electricity production system is based on coal. So in the U.S., that's more than 50%, and there are plans to expand it, including, for example, there's a big power station that's supposed to come in New Mexico online in the next few years. And China is really, as with everything, it seems, the place where the most momentous change is happening. And it's basically building the energy capacity of the UK each year, and basically this is building two power stations, two large coal-fired power stations a week. So this is legacy that typically stays with you for 50 years, and that really is where the problem is. It's also very dirty coal and so forth, but that's a different discussion. Mm. On the other hand, you know, when you look at the promise of things, you've probably seen something like this. It's from Wikipedia, so you might have seen it there. But there's technology on photovoltaics and so forth. But if you want to produce the whole energy needs of current expenditures worldwide, then you just need to cover something like these little blobs at current technological efficiency. And that's plenty more energy where that comes from, of course. All energy comes from there. So the question is, can you make that transition with solar and other the technology so that you have a decarbonized economy in the energy production system, and one with, that doesn't affect climate change and so forth. So here's the bottom line. The bottom line is the following. The problem with renewables is that they produce energy at prices that are, at the moment, too expensive. So this is trying to illustrate that. The colors are a little bit strange now, a little bit darker than I'm used to, but this is basically grid electricity, usually produced from fossil fuels. If you live in the U.S., most likely from coal again. And here's basically, for example, solar, but you can do exactly the same plot for your favorite technology. Wind is a little cheaper. And so the idea is that there'll be a time, sometime in the future, when it will be the same price or cheaper to produce energy via new technologies than by traditional technologies. The idea that this is going up is a little bit hopeful. It relies on regulation and carbon taxes and carbon markets, which may or may not be implemented. I mean, they're working in Europe, but not here. And so, and solar has been coming down, and basically what you have here is that this transition also happens locally. Places that have expensive energy, like islands, where without coal or other resources, like Hawaii, have basically an energy system that's already favoring transitioning completely to renewables. Italy, on the other hand, is a larger country, but I believe most of their electricity is produced from diesel, so that's not a product, it's very expensive at the moment, and it's also a sunny country, so that's another place where it's actually cheaper now to produce all your energy from solar. Of course, the problem is one of lock-in, the fact that the current system is not that, and you need to change everything. But if you made that investment, you'd save money at the moment. Other countries, I tried to put them here, China and India is around here as well, maybe even a little bit lower. And then you see how different countries with different energy costs, and also importantly for solar at least, with different incidences of solar energy, will go through this transition at different times. Yeah?
I'm sorry, do those prices include government incentives and taxes?
Yeah, these are basically, these are the prices of generation So it's complicated because of all those things. But so, for example, in China and India and the United States, to some extent, fossil fuel production of electricity is very subsidized. In Europe, it tends to be taxed. So the actual price is somewhere, you know, around there. But then there are incentives for this, and the price that you see here for solar is also including incentives. So at the moment in the US, the price is probably around here. And the idea is that these two curves shall meet perhaps as soon as 2015 for the US and for most of the world. So that's sort of an interesting problem where if that happens, you have a problem of substitution of technology rather than, which is less exciting from a scientific point of view, but a good news, rather than a problem of actually having to innovate fundamentally in technology. But so this gives you an idea that there's a regional and energy technology dependent sort of path where these things will start happening. And so what this does is basically promote innovation in certain places rather than others potentially, and also give different places like nations different incentives. And so it creates sort of an idea where there's a technological race on the one hand, and on the other hand, the structure of incentives locally, regionally, and is potentially different. So what's interesting to me is try to think of how to study a process of innovation like this and see how this transition will happen. So this is done in the context of a few projects. Here's just Lean that's in the audience. And so we're trying to put together this database of patents. We put it together of energy technologies. I'll describe a little bit more about it in a second. It's mostly just Lean's work. And I'll show you some of the analysis. And then we have two other projects. This is being done in part under an NSF grant modeling dynamics and of technological evolution and a particular. So the idea is try to extract what are the dynamics by which we create new technology and in some sense new science. And there are plenty of online examples where that could be done as well. So I'd love to talk to some of you if you have other examples where that might happen. I think it'll become clear what I mean as I go. And then we also have a more applied grant on basically mapping what people mean by sustainability science with Kari Berner in Indiana. And then there's an initiative at Los Alamos, I'll show you just a slide about it, of basically mapping the entire world energy infrastructure on Google Maps. And it's obviously a very ambitious thing to do. It's not clear if you can do it all, but the idea is to basically create a wiki environment where people contribute with a solar panel or their knowledge and create basically a map that tracks that. And that some of it is online. It's very dark, but this is South Africa. And South Africa is another country that has plentiful coal resources, and these are all their coal mines. And basically there's some of these are actually power plants and coal mines that are co-located. That's also true in the United States. A lot of the electricity that we're consuming here comes from Wyoming and other places like that, so the coal mines are, and also what you burn to produce electricity. So in South Africa, they have a similar system, and then that feeds the cities and so forth. But they also export, and so then the railway that brings it here and so forth. There's a whole infrastructure. But if you have an interest or a passion or knowledge about this, there's a Google Maps environment that you can contribute your knowledge and so forth. Okay, so what I want to do for the rest of the talk, which is really the part to do with data and data analysis, is basically try to measure innovation and investment and in some extent production and cost. I won't talk much about that today. That has to do with sort of learning curves and technology, and the data is still a bit iffy, but we have information about this. I can talk to you online. So the idea is, you know, how are we having this convergence between technologies? Can it be accelerated? And perhaps more important for some of you that may be interested in other areas, are there sort of general characteristics, general quantitative signatures of scientific and technological innovation that tell you when you made a breakthrough or not, even if you just look at how people collaborate or about literatures or patents over time? Okay, so there's been an interesting story to do with incentives in energy technologies relative to other technologies. And it's told more or less, there's an interesting paper by these two authors, Margolis and Kamen. That's a paper in Science and in Energy Policy, has more details. And here's basically what you see here are different sort of industries. This is data for the US. And in particular here, you see a timeline of drugs, the drug industry, and energy. And what you see here on the axis is basically R&D, This is R&D, and this is R&D as net of sales. So basically, it tells you how much you invest versus how much you sell. And what's interesting is that energy is one of the sectors that has the least R&D intensity, as people in economics would say. So there are basically the drug industry, as you know, is very much driven by currently by drug discovery, since basically patents on drugs and the rights to produce them do expire. So big pharmaceuticals have to keep finding new products so that they can keep making money. Whereas in energy, of course, you can also patent technologies and so forth, but it's been a sector that, particularly since the early 80s, has been massively disinvested. I'll show you actually that those trends are being reversed right now in interesting ways, both driven by money and also just driven by people innovating without money. So this is a plot you probably have seen as well in publications and so forth. It's just the price of oil. And this is a plot about number of patents. Historically, this is again for the US and funding. You see that they track each other more or less, at least qualitatively. But you also see that this peak over here corresponds to the late 70s to early 80s. And if you look over here, basically those are historically the times when oil was most expensive. And of course now we're already here again. And you'll see that the trend that you saw then, that you had a lot of investment into innovation then, is repeating itself now, but even more strongly. So there are good news, but that will be part of the story that I'll try to illustrate. So in some sense, when things are cheap, it's business as usual, and when things are expensive, actually that generates diversity and creation of new ideas. So that's sort of interesting. But this story in between is obviously kind of sad, and it brought us to where we are. Okay. So let me tell you a little bit about what we've been trying to do with assembling data on trying to measure this innovation in energy technology.
So sure. What happened at that point? Why was so expensive I don't know about this part of the history. So why was so expensive in the 80s?
Here?
Yeah.
So, I'm not an economist and I didn't follow it then, but the story that we get told today is that basically there was an OPEC cartel. There's the war with Israel and Arab countries. This is this first spike, and then there was the Iranian Revolution, and OPEC as a cartel together cuts production. So that's that major spike, mm-hmm. And then there were other things in Iran, and then Reagan comes to power, and then that's that. So that's more or less the story we hear, and this is when the OPEC cartel collapses. So that obviously they. As the main producers, they control prices to some extent, at least qualitatively. And here are the recent wars, and now we really are back here again. So that's if you've been following the news. So the idea is that remember that oil actually is only a small fraction of all energy production. It's very important for transportation. It's very psychological. So coal actually has been becoming cheaper, but still it seems that this drives a lot of innovation in the sectors that compete, for example, with coal. So there's an interesting and complicated story. Okay, but in any case, so what we've done is to basically do, we improved on the search from the data I showed you just before. There's a tradition in compiling these patterns that you see here. And so we improved on the data set. The data set was just for the United States Patent and Trademark Office. So we've done this now worldwide. Theirs is a keyword search. We basically improved it a little bit, we believe, to reduce noise and false positives. And we've also added a few sectors. So what we've done is basically, I can give you the details, but it's a keyword search, basically, where we concentrate on energy generation, not transportation or other related things, but energy generation from different sources. And so petroleum, coal and natural gas with fossil fuels, and then solar, wind, geothermal, hydroelectric biofuels for renewables, and then the nuclear sector. Of course, this exists, and this is basically a hope for the future, but doesn't quite exist as a technology. What we've done as well is that Thomson Scientific, which is used to public, ISI, used to be, used to be ISI, now it's Thomson, correct me if I'm saying this wrong, but also assembles, as they assemble the Web of Science, they also assemble patents worldwide. And so we have access to this database through the Los Alamos Research Library, and it's from there that we've built basically these databases, and they cover essentially every patent office around the world. So the biggest ones are the USPTO, so US Patent Trademark Office. Japan is actually larger. China is an interesting story. I'll tell you a little bit about that. And European Patent Office is also an interesting story of a different kind, and so forth. But basically, we have patents worldwide, and we can tell both regional trends and temporal trends. And the numbers, just to give you an idea. So these cover basically since the 60s, or late 60s, more or less. Before that, patenting was not very common, and it's just sort of accidental in these technologies. So what you see is that basically there are about, you know, altogether something like 50-something thousand patents, and this is just for reference. The United States is actually much less dominant in patenting than it is scientifically. So that's also an interesting story you may not be aware of, and it kind of, makes it interesting, at least in my eyes. But you'll see that the largest sector, actually, in terms of innovation, is actually solar. Right? This is a recent development, but it's interesting. And then you see that the big four are basically coal, oil, solar, and wind. And then some sectors are actually fairly small. Biofuels, in spite of a lot of European investment, is very small. And the nuclear fission, which is obviously exists, and it's a fairly old technology, is also very small compared to fusion that doesn't exist and so forth. Yeah, there's a question there. This one's more or less from 1968 till present, till a few weeks ago. Okay, so the first thing I want to just, so from this data you can do many things, and what I'll show you is part of the analysis that's going on, but you may want to know basically which nations innovate in which sector. So patents are interesting for several reasons. Yeah, there's another question.
Just a comment, so you're making the assumption that innovation is the number of patents that it is.
Well, it's a measure, it's obviously not complete
measure. 95% of patents don't make money, and if you define innovation as conversion of patents into money,
that's true for papers too, right? I mean, well, not my name, but citations and so forth, probably more. No, that's true, but this is like anything in the spirit of what we've been talking about here this week, that you have traces of what people do. I mean, they're very silly patents, but by and large, they express an idea that went through some, yeah.
I think it would be good to correlate the private sector investment in these areas, especially the venture companies.
Yeah.
And see whether there's a relationship between them and the patents.
Absolutely, so there is. Recently, that's what's been going on. But the data is limited on R&D investment from private companies. But let's talk offline. But I basically will show you aggregated R&D. Basically, the private sector at the moment, just to give you an idea, it's about a fourth in terms of dollars, but strategic investment is different. It's about a fourth of federal R&D in the United States. So the country that's dominant in patents is Japan, not the US, by sheer numbers. And then the US is second. This is patents, every patent. So this is from the World Intellectual Property Office, and they have a very interesting report every year. So if you're interested in patents, this is something to read. And this is just basically the world breakdown of that. So these
are not just energy related?
These are not, the following will be. This is just more or less to give you context.
Okay.
It's not very different for energy, as you'll see. But this is not our plot. This is basically from a report. And the story when this report came out was, so there's Japan, there's the US, and the red is China. So you see that China came basically from nothing in early 80s to basically becoming the third largest patent office at the moment. And some of it is actually people patenting in China from outside. And here's the other story that's interesting, which is the European Patent Office, at least for me, being European, that has had growth, and you see also other European countries, like here, that have been basically disappearing. This, of course, has been taking part of their intellectual property, but the growth is different. Then the other interesting, two other interesting stories. One is Korea. Korea is the country where, if you correlate investment in R&D to patenting rates, is the one where you have most patents, so most returns in terms of patenting versus investment. So, and you see it's basically almost the size of China for total patents. And then the other interesting story is the Soviet Union and then Russia. You see that until the late 80s, it was actually patenting more than the United States, and then it crashed a little bit. So this investment is also an issue. And now, this is now for energy technologies, and so what we're showing here are not basically the same thing, but the segregated in sectors. So in the US Patent Trademark Office, what you have is that, again, so these are historical trends, and you see again that there's this sharp rise in the late 70s and the 80s, and then basically, this is number of patents per year, sorry. So it stayed constant for a long time, even went down probably, and then this is the good news now that you haven't seen before in previous plots, is that about 10 years ago we've entered a stage where there's tremendous innovation happening in all sectors of energy, in fact, but the trend that tends to correlate with that is the increase in renewables, which is the green line, versus fossil fuels, which still, as you can see, is going up as well. And nuclear tends not to register. And this is for Japan. Think of Japan again as sort of the dominant place. I don't know what happened there. I have to investigate. But in any case, you see a similar trend of, again, renewables overtaking fossil fuels. And then the similar story for China and Europe. China is always different a little bit. So it's sort of interesting to see, sort of on the time delay, and spiking very sharply, but you see that that trend that we saw before is just about to happen, probably. And this is Europe. It's much more constant. Patenting is sort of not as important there, partly because, in answer to your question, a lot of European research is really driven by incentives and European Union grants on energy. So that's a tremendous effort, but it's not driven by venture capital so much. It's happening now, so but that leads to different way in which people relate to intellectual property. So but you see the same trend again. So what you, this is sort of the good news that I'll show you some other plots that correlate then to R&D funding. But it's telling you that renewables really are now taking most of the, renewables are increasing in innovation, whereas you see a trend for fossil fuels to be less interesting. There are still actually good reasons to try to solve the problems associated with fossil fuels, like carbon sequestration storage for coal, and obviously transportation and other things in oil, but still that means that those trends are smaller. And this is sort of the, it's maybe complicated, but it's the sectoral and country sort of breakdown. So here's Japan again, and here's, so it's sort of by size. So here's Japan, here's the United States, here's China and Europe, and then other nations. So you see actually that biofuels is distinctly different. It's a much smaller sector, as I'll show you in a second. But you see basically that, for example, Japan has a small presence in biofuels, but there are a lot of world patents. So these are patents where you find, where, you know, you can claim intellectual property around the world. It tends to be filed sometimes by smaller nations. And you have like Canada and so forth. But then you also see that, this varies a lot. For example, China has a strong presence in coal, which is their main resource and so forth. So there are several interesting patterns here in which, you know, Japan is important in nuclear, which is one of their main resources, or the traditional ways of producing energy and so forth. So there's sort of interesting patterns in which that we haven't done this by country, but we have some information about what each country is investing in terms of R&D. So the question is whether that's reflected here or not. Presumably to some extent it is, but okay. Now let me tell you a little bit about the temporal trends. So the temporal trends, this is on a log scale on the y-axis. And you see typically these two things. So these are inventors, and these are patents. So the idea that they're different tells you a little bit about the average team size. And here it's not very clear, but you see that this changes a little bit over time. So what you see is basically that the growth is approximately exponential, but it had two phases, again, coinciding with the break in the early 80s. But it's interesting, this is, if you look at fields of science, most fields of science grow exponentially. Almost everything grows approximately exponentially. It's very interesting. And this is what you see on a yearly basis. So this, before it was cumulative, and this is now just patents per year. So what you see here are basically that the number of patents per year is approximately constant for coal. It's maybe increasing, but approximately constant for petroleum. But for renewables, actually, this rate is considerably larger, and that's sort of the trend that you saw in the previous slides. So these are the number of new patents per year, and you see that the rate of change is increasing. So we're quantifying this and correlating this to funding as well. But But basically, there's good news in the sense, too, that there's not only interest, but increasing interest and acceleration in the trends to innovate in these sectors. And this is biofuels, for comparison, it's very small. But you see that it's starting to take off just very recently. And I'll show you some of the network structure as well. But you see that I gave this talk at a conference where a lot of biofuels people, and they had absolutely no concept how small their field was compared to other fields. Okay, the other thing I want to do now is to basically, economists, so one of the most important things about producing ideas, or wealth for that matter, that again is not very sometimes taken into account, including perhaps some of the behavior, social behavior we might have also online, is that typically the amount of effort that you put into things translates into collective outputs that are not linear in that effort. And economists usually create a very simple measure, which is basically a relationship between input and output. So here's input, which could be, in this case, you can think of labor or money, and output, which could be patents, but it could also be something else. But you know, for scientific papers, of course, you can think about the same thing. Or you can think about number of papers and citations, or whatever you think is the measure of value, and whatever you think is the measure of input. But what's interesting is that we talked about power laws. These things are almost always power laws with a certain exponent, and I'll show you some examples. But whenever this exponent is greater than one, what happens is that for a unit of input, you're creating more units of output. So you're actually getting so-called increasing returns. So that's a good thing if you're interested in what is being returned. And it tells you that you actually can accelerate, you know, each dollar or whatever they invest or hour actually produces more and more returns. So you're basically on a trajectory of expanding your output with the same amount of investment, or you can maintain the output with a smaller amount of investment if you want. But there are also, sometimes you see the opposite, although I won't give you examples, and of course the trivial case is that it's just proportional, but this almost never happens. So a lot of what's interesting, that is sort of the magic of social interaction, is that it creates these effects that are not proportional to the inputs and effort. And these are some examples. So these are just number of patents versus number of inventors. So this is a proxy for labor hours. It's not the most exciting measure. But basically the idea is that these exponents, curiously, they're the same for oil and coal. They're about the same, and they're 16% above one. So you have increasing returns in that sense in patents for fossil fuels. But the fact, this is basically now, these fits are biased towards the later points because they're much bigger. And that's also more interesting. These are the most recent points. You see that these effects are much larger for solar and wind. So the idea, again, is that as people join the field and write patents in these technologies, everyone is producing more patents a little bit. So that's the idea, is that the field's sort of accelerating as it grows, everyone gets more productive. And that's true of all these fields, but it's more true of these fields that are related to fossil fuels, to renewables. So this is sort of an interesting effect that I'd love to see if there's a way to measure online for other quantities where we may have the behavior of people a little bit more under control, or we can measure other things about it. This is sort of on the aggregate. Is there a question there?
Would it be a diminishing return?
No, it tends to be proportional in the beginning, and then there are other examples where it can be diminishing returns. So for example, if you do the same thing with papers, I won't show you that today, but we've done analysis of different scientific fields, not technological fields, and there are fields where if you do the similar thing, they show diminishing returns, and they tend, in the examples, they're anecdotal that we've collected examples across science, they tend to be biomedical fields or intensely experimental biological fields where, you know, anecdotally the idea is that you need a big team to even do the experiment and publish the result, but that doesn't mean that everyone in the team publishes more. But, you know, that sort of effect can happen, that you have a threshold, but just because you cross the threshold doesn't mean that everyone publishes more. Whereas typically in other fields, if it's, you know, relatively free to write a paper or a patent or whatever it might be, then if somebody produces a paper, typically that enriches the set of ideas, you know, they have in the field, and you have a chance also to write about that, or to write about what somebody else's work, and this creates sort of the opposite effect, where you have more chances and more people join, and the whole thing accelerates, and you have this effect. So we think this is what's happening here, is that basically that many more approaches, many more people working these technologies, and the rate just accelerates. It's the same thing probably with web content. You know, as more things are on the web, more people come in to interact in more different ways, to create yet more things and so forth. And that would be wonderful to measure. Yeah.
One more question. On the end of that. Is the duration and nature of the patents different than pharmaceuticals? Is it like what is the length of time that you're
patenting? It's the same.
It's exactly the same.
Yeah.
Okay.
I forget what it is actually. It's 20 years.
Years.
Yeah. Filippo and then.
So to what extent this could also be a reflection just as a control of the lowering cost of whatever it is that you're measuring as output. So for example, in papers you could imagine that there's a lot of growth in publications.
Yeah.
But part of that is also because in general we're all publishing more and there's inflation.
Right.
You know, it could be that the unit of publication is decreasing for various political reasons. But and also that the cost is lowering for various technological reasons.
Right. So that's
so then you would see an overall growth everywhere that doesn't necessarily mean that there is a growth in productivity or innovation.
Right.
And is there a way to
So we know some of those effects are at play in the sense that there's much more drive to, in this case, patent or publish. It's, you know, we have to because everyone's doing it. And there are supporting structures like your companies or your universities measure you by doing that and so forth. But that would tend to affect the temporal trends, obviously. Now, what I'm showing here is just the trends of how many people are working in the field versus how much they are publishing. So, obviously, if you're competing with more people, perhaps you have an incentive also to publish more. But you have to find things. So whatever the effect is, it's not necessarily just because of here it's really just relating, you can think of how much you produce.
It's a derivative.
Yeah.
You're saying you're looking at the derivative, not the original.
Right, and it's not just the temporal trend, it's not just exogenous information, it's actually the number of patents you produce versus how much you work, how many people are working in the field. So it's a little bit different. Time is always a confounding, actually, effect, a variable, because all kinds of things can happen if you plot things over time. If you plot it, that's the idea here, is that if you plot it versus inputs, like how many people are working in the field, how much money is coming to the field, then you're just seeing, as I add a person, what do I expect the field to produce? Or as I add a dollar or $1 million, what do I expect the field to produce? So speaking of which, this is money. Do you have a question? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I probably should speed up. But here's basically, this is an analysis relative to money, not inventors, and this is for worldwide number of patents and investment. So here's the trend again for this investment in fossil fuel technologies, and here's the trend of investment into into renewables. So you see that was a huge gap here, it's still not made up by the trend, but the trend is for also investment here to increase. And this is true of both R&D that's private and sort of governmental. And what you find here when you look at patents, you also see sort of, I showed you this before, but this is now for patents worldwide, for everything aggregated, that there's a huge gap now being created and most of the innovation is starting to be here. So that's sort of the good news. And when you correlate these changes versus money invested, this is what you get. You get sort of the effect I was describing before, but now relative to money. So this is the cumulative number of patents in renewables and fossil fuels. And these are the fits to a gamma power law with an exponent greater than one. But what you see is that, again, interestingly enough, you have the same effect. You have increasing returns also in fossil fuels, but the effect is stronger for renewables. So if you had to choose where to put your money, one place or the other, then you should put it in renewables. But in any case, that's what you're measuring. So these are all good signs that actually something important is happening in the way people perceive the opportunity of creating these technologies. So what I want to do now is to give you an idea of what's happening to how people collaborate as the right patterns, so the usual networks of collaboration. And I'll try to make the point there are some general features that happen whenever people invent things and work as a field. So if you've read the Structure Scientific Revolution, there's a lot of food for thought there. But one of the ideas is that whenever you create a field, so you have sort of a discovery and people can work on these new themes, there's sort of this idea that, you know, in the beginning, this is also in many books on the history of technology, you know, there are a few people working on different things. Approaches, I don't know, how to build a plane, or to solve, or build a better solar panel. And then usually there's a moment where one of these may discover a way, but then there's a moment that Kuhn calls invention. The idea is when does that idea become usable so that other people can come in and reproduce their calculation or expand it or use that technology. And that's when basically people come in and start collaborating because there's now a common language that didn't necessarily exist here. And when that happens, I mean, he almost says it in the book, but he expects that the fields grow, obviously, in time. But they also change structurally in the sense that people can collaborate, so the graph tends to become denser, if you think of it as a graph, and to basically have a giant component where people are exchanging ideas. And I'll show you that this is actually a feature that appears in almost every patent each one of these technologies, and then, of course, eventually may dissolve again. The idea becomes outdated, but we won't go here. We don't have information on this. And there's some precedent from several fields in seeing this sort of effect. Here's what happened to a field of RNAi that there was a Nobel Prize a couple years ago, I believe. And this is basically the person or persons who won the Nobel Prize. And here's probably very hard to see from the back, but you see that in the beginning, all kinds of little separate efforts and teams. You see that basically, in biochemistry, people have to work in teams, and then, you know, more teams, and they start to aggregate, and then eventually you end up with a network like this. And this, curiously enough, this is a very interesting paper by Stephen Lucy, and it's basically about Broadway musicals, and it's making the same point that people used to work different kinds of musicals and so forth, and there was a magical time when everyone recognizes as sort of the heyday of when the best musicals were built, and it's basically at the time when this network starts connecting, and when, you know, a lot of people start fusing all these different ideas that were creating in the initial part to create this sort of moment of excitement, and then, you know, you have this conformist phase where everyone's doing the same thing, which is where we are now. So let me show you how this can be measured in terms of a couple of things. These are examples from science that I just pulled up from another talk. Give you an idea. Well, you see here a fraction of edges and largest components. So basically, as you measure edges in these graphs, these are not very good graphs, but the question is how many are inside the largest component here, and how many are outside the largest component. And this is a measure essentially of, if you're a physicist, you've thought about percolation, and so percolation is basically, you know, when you, it's basically throwing things in space and seeing if they're nearby, you connect them. So the idea is that whenever you have enough density, you connect, and you have this large component, and there are a few isolated little clusters. So this is very analogous to that.
You measure relative to the large component?
Yeah.
Okay.
So what you have here are basically a fraction of edges and largest component. In the beginning, you have a lot of fluctuations because the field's very small. And this is string theory, if you care to know. And basically, this is the moment that string theorists tell you when there was a revolution, and there's the largest component. And this is Scrapion-Bryant, which is also another example we looked at. And this is a more complicated story, but basically there were several sort of discoveries that also led to a similar effect. And what's interesting is that when a field doesn't really exist, it doesn't do this. So here's cold fusion. Again, fluctuations in the beginning, don't pay attention to that. But cold fusion, you'd be surprised, but there are, you know, 1637 papers as of last year. Authors, and I should say 171 papers. But people are not collaborating. In fact, there are all these different approaches. Each one has sort of that crazy way of doing it, and they hate each other. I got a lot of hate mail when this talk went online, so this is probably going to happen again. So that, you know, the discussion groups where people throw ideas at each other and say how great the field is, but basically disagree about everything, you know, how to do this. So in some sense, you can see that if cold fusion, what I told them is that, you know, I'm sure cold fusion could become a mature field, but, you know, signs are that that hasn't happened yet. So, which is true. So in any case, so let me now show you what happens to some of these energy technologies, and I'll start with small ones that have sort of basically not gone through this transition yet, and then I'll show you some other ones that have gone through that transition. So biofuels is, as I showed you a little bit before, one of the smallest fields in terms of patents. So now it's patents, not papers. And One thing you can see, so one way of seeing the effect is that there's an interesting paper by John Kleinberg and a couple collaborators that measured many different networks, not necessarily to do with this, but they noticed that many networks densify, meaning that if you just measure edges and nodes, and if you plot one against the other, which is what I'm doing here as well, so edges versus nodes, what you see is that the number of edges are going to parallel, so it's a log-log plot. You see the number of edges versus nodes tends to increase sometimes with an exponent greater than 1. This is actually an exponent that's about 1 and speaks to a question that we got earlier. And this is biofuel, so you know it's just basically still adding these small components, mostly at the periphery. This is the graph of co-invention, so co-authorship in patents. And you see that there's a little larger component, but it's not very dominant yet. And this is basically, it's hard to see here, it's very scattered, but it's that measure of fraction of edges in the largest component, but it's not gone through that transition where it goes to 1. So this is still probably a young field, and there are many different sorts of themes in here, and we know that, and so forth. So here's another one, which is fairly young, but for some reason, you see basically from the network graph, these graphs, I wanted to have put this here, but I realized just now that I forgot the graphs were done by a kid in Maine at our research library, but it's his work. And so basically what you see here is that there's already a large component, although there's still a lot of these disaggregated little satellite clusters. And when you look at the same sort of measure, here's the densification effect, and this is 1.2, so it's 20% effect, and you'll see that this is a very general property that you see in all these fields. And so if you have a network where as you add nodes, it becomes denser and denser, necessarily at some point, if you think in terms of percolation, it will percolate and you'll form a large component. So that's basically what's going on. And as you look here, basically you'll see that, you know, in around 1992, perhaps this went through this transition where you created a large giant component. Wind. You see already that actually there are probably less and less of these components that are not aggregated to the main one. We're still doing some controls on this because Jaslin in particular pointed out there are some authors that have very common names and there may be more than one, so we have to do a few things like that. But you know, so this is where it is now, but same sort of effect. You see that here was a different exponent, maybe, I think it's even a good fit, but recently it's a good fit there. Same sort of transition, it's now more or less around the same time, curiously. And solar is a very dense field, and this is a thresholded graph with, we removed anything that has less than 10 connections, and you see some of the components in here, but, you know, so there's structure inside that huge blob, but again, the same idea that there are very few, there are fewer and fewer people outside. And the same sort of effect, a little bit more mature, the densification, the transition. And how am I doing? I probably should finish in 5 minutes, but it's okay. So we're getting there. So coal is even, in some sense, more aggregated. Here's the same idea. And here's the same effect. So there's basically this very general effect. We're trying to do a little bit what Sander Fortunato was describing for a different sort of data set and quantities, but in the sense that this is suggesting that there's basically a kind of universal transition that's set by the densification effect and the formation of largest components, sort of a critical phenomenon. Yeah, good question. So we're trying to collapse all these lines, just to finish that thought, into the same one to try to make the point that this process is general.
And looking at the curve for coal,
yeah.
It looks like that one is kind of the transition in the mid-80s.
That's right, much earlier. Yeah.
You know what that could have been?
No, there's several effects. First, as you saw,
price. People
didn't used to, price and coal. Well, I think there was a transition where coal remained, in fact, got cheaper, and oil at that time got expensive. And at the same time, there are the temporal trends that Filippo was asking about, which is people also started patenting one. So there's a certain number of effects of growth of the field and also incentives for this field to take off that probably did that. But it's exactly right that the transition points in time are very different for different fields. And as you know, as you see, the newer technologies that I show you are much more recent, late 90s or early 90s. And these, you know, the more traditional renewables are early 90s and these are in the 80s. And petroleum. Petroleum is actually the sector that's hardest to sort of constrain in the sense that oil products appear in almost everything, and you know, from paints to lubricants to all kinds of things. And when we search, then sort of eyeball the results, we know that we have more noise there. But in any case, we tried to then just isolate terms that had to do with energy production. But this is a field that has a bit more uncertainty. And again, you see the same similar effect. There's something perhaps interesting going on here, but the densification effect is very clear. And then you have basically these exponents vary a little bit, but you know, they're between, for all these sectors that are densifying, 1.2, 1.3. And then you have this effect again, a little bit later than cold, but a little bit earlier than the other factors, the other sectors. And this is a graph that we kind of worked on last night, so it's a little bit still work in progress. But the problem is essentially how do you, so this is not to do with that effect. That effect, what I wanted to say is that it's quite general. But these are just basically the interdependencies between sectors. So, and the node size denotes the size of the fields, so this is the largest, these are the big four. But you also see how nuclear fission, how biofuels are really very, very much smaller than the other ones. And then you see that actually there's some interesting things in the sense that, for example, solar and oil have actually a lot of connections, because it just happened that recently some of the traditionally oil companies like BP and other companies have started initiative. There's now BP Solar, which is one of the largest photovoltaic producers in the world. So they obviously also shifting their portfolios to match what you see here, this sort of trend, and probably also driving this trend to actually create the transition. And so you see some of these connections and synergies between sectors. So with this, I apologize, that's still a work in progress. And I know Jocelyn worked hard to get that even so that I can show you. Okay, so that's what I want to leave at. You see that basically what I showed you is still very much work in progress with a lot of data. We have data also on other things like inventors and their specific country of residence rather than where they patent assignees. So which companies and people actually own these patents. It's interesting for other reasons, right? And also we have some information on sort of the technological. There's this idea of learning curves that as you install more and produce more, the price goes down. So this is basically how do you relate install capacity to cost and now to measures of innovation and so forth. So that you have the, sort of the integrated economic and social and sort of technological relationships. So, but the idea then is that we have this database. There are many things we could do with it. We also wanted to do some text analysis of what's inside these fields, since there are different approaches. So if anyone's interested in helping us, Johan's been helping us already a little bit with things like this and string theory and other things I showed you. So we have some work in progress, but I think there's opportunities there. So the idea is that you as you can see, now technological innovation, investment, human capital follow different trends for different technologies. There's sort of this transition towards renewables. And that if you want to put your money somewhere or your time, and if you're a technologist, you're better off doing it in renewables. And also that these general properties that kind of, they're structural and that tell you essentially when a community is zeroed down on a few ideas that allows them to collaborate through. And that's typically a sign of idea diffusion and productive collaboration, and that these effects may be general. Okay, thanks.